Good day, and welcome to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, your host, and as always, I'm glad you've joined us. There is a concept that drives a lot of American politics, and it goes a little like this. This is a nation of states, and as such, states should have broad leeway and a high priority when coming up with ideas for the people. They form those ideas into legislation, and when they hit on something that really works, when that legislation bears fruit, nearby states take notice and say, hey, we might want to do the same thing. This is a process that is often called laboratories of democracy. It's meant to imply that our policies and preferences don't just come from lawmakers on high, but from those who live more closely to us and how we kind of learn and borrow from each other. But as Americans become more polarized, is it fair to say that this process even works anymore? Are Nevadans, for instance, adopting good policies that they learn from Californians? Are Floridians learning from their Georgian neighbors? Think about the road arguments that we have here in Michigan and how we won't even look to a state like Ohio, where if you cross the border on I-75, all of a sudden, the roads are like glass there. There's no potholes and all this other crazy stuff that we put up with. How come we don't go and try to learn? What are they doing in Ohio? Very close by state with similar weather that makes their roads last longer. Even more broadly, are state governments stepping in when partisanship throws federal lawmakers into gridlock? Are they taking up to experiment more and learn from each other, even as the federal government is somewhat in stasis? University of Washington political scientist Jake Grumbach doesn't think so. His recent book, Laboratories Against Democracy, describes how national party polarization has warped not just national politics, but also state politics. So with the Michigan midterm elections in our rearview mirror and many voters having exerted their political desires across the country, we wanted to know, is there a chance for states to learn more from each other? Did this ever really happen at all, or was it a myth? Are state parties able to overcome partisanship in a way that national ones seem not to be able to do? And can local and state politics be a more meaningful and democratic space for voters compared to one that often feels so far away in Washington? Detroit Today producer Sam Corey sat down with Professor Jake Grumbach to find out.
So to start off here, you argue that the states have become nationalized in their politics, that they're focusing on national politics so much, and it's essentially reverberating back into state legislators in the way that they create policies. I'm curious, what is causing the nationalization of our state politics?
Yeah, so that's exactly right. So, you know, we think back to the famous Tip O'Neill phrase, all politics is local, but now all politics is national. So, you know, voter attention is on national politics and national sort of, you know, cultural conflict and national issues. Politicians are focused at the national level. Local and state level politicians have ambitions for national goals and to achieve power nationally. So this is a big shift from a generation ago. And what's causing that? There's a few important factors. One is the nationalization of fundraising, where now through the internet and through the mail, you can fund any politician, and groups, national groups, can get involved in state and local politics across the country, no matter where they're based. And then the second big cause is the nationalization of political media. So a generation ago, we had many times more journalists on the state and local politics beat in, you know, boring state legislatures covering what's going on. Now, with the rise of the internet, the rise of Craigslist destroying classified ad revenue for newspapers, the rise of national media conglomerates on cable news and the internet, all of that has contributed to more attention to national issues and less attention to what's going on at the state and local level.
Is there any benefit to truly having more power to the states rather than the federal government? I think a lot of people think that it would give people more control over their politics. They'd be more engaged in their politics. You seem to be arguing against that, and I'm wondering why that's not true, why, in fact, the federal government is oftentimes more representative than state and local institutions.
That's exactly right. So going all the way back to, you know, the founders and James Madison, there was this argument that if we decentralize authority and give states a lot of leeway to do the policies they want, they can customize policy based on their constituencies. You know, so more conservative places could have more restrictive, let's say in today, you know, LGBT rights or, you know, abortion policies in more conservative areas and more liberal policies in more liberal areas. And everybody's going to live in, you know, greater harmony. And while there's some important truth to that, today what's happened with the nationalized political parties, where the Democratic and Republican parties are two national teams, is now there's not that sort of customization based on local constituencies. Rather, when your state is controlled by one party or the other, you basically know what that state is going to do, and it's getting less responsive to the actual desires of constituencies. And that's because at the local level, again, declining attention to state and local politics means that sort of wealthier interests, corporations, they have a lot greater influence on state and local politics, whereas all of us know sort of what's going on in national politics and which direction we want the country to go in.
Is it fair then to say, which I think, you know, in part you're suggesting, that not having a lot of local news options, it's literally about information ecosystems and people not knowing what's going on at the state and local level?
Yeah, that is a huge part of it. So it's really hard to know how to vote. I'm a PhD in political science. I'm a professor of political science. I have a really hard time knowing how to vote in, let's say, like a state legislative primary or for a state level judicial election for judge, right? It's really hard to know who's performing well, who to blame when things go wrong. There's so many levels of government. So if something's going wrong in your town or state, it's really hard to know. Do you blame the president? Do you blame Congress? Do you blame your governor? Do you blame your mayor? Do you blame, you know, the county commission? And so forth. It's really hard to know to blame in this system of so many levels of government. But, you know, who does have a lot of information about the fine print of what state and local politicians are doing? And that's the professionals, the people who, you know, are lobbyists for large businesses or for national interest groups on issues like abortion or LGBT rights or the environment and so forth, or the NRA on guns. They have the information to be able to influence state and local politics in a way that ordinary voters can't.
I'm wondering how great things have really been in this instance or on this topic. I know, of course, you know, you're riffing on the laboratories of democracy idea. And you talk a lot about the sort of maybe glorification of this concept of states really being, you know, sort of better places for representation, or the idea that they're more likely to push for, say, voting rights or civil rights, which, of course, is oftentimes not true, right? In fact, it's the opposite. But I'm curious if there was ever a time when states really seemed to be learning from each other and getting better, creating policy in one area and then taking up in another. Like, has Iowa ever been like really learning from Ohio and Rhode Island from Massachusetts in a way that's not true today?
Yeah, so there's a few different key points there. One is that on this learning aspect, so, you know, the famous Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis called the states laboratories of democracy. And by that, he meant that states can do policy experiments and learn from each other. One state can, you know, legalize recreational marijuana. And if it goes well, other states can go, oh, that didn't like burn down the state. Maybe we can implement that here. And there's some evidence that sort of story was a bit stronger in the past when states were not engaged in these national political battles as much. They could learn from neighboring states, whereas now states really just learn from other states that are controlled by the same political party. So after the financial crisis, states controlled by Republicans and states controlled by Democrats did not learn much from each other. So a state like Minnesota in the Midwest did a pretty strong job recovering from the 2008 financial crisis and more recently in the COVID era with better labor protections. Whereas Michigan, one unfortunate thing has been the change in sort of policy towards labor rights, the right to work law, for example, in 2013, that does not reflect sort of learning about best economic policy practices from its neighbor. But then there's another whole side to the story, which is how do states engage with democracy itself? Do states run free and fair elections? Do they, you know, gerrymander districts really heavily? And there, the story throughout history has unfortunately been that the state legislative level is the main threat to American democracy. It's often the Supreme Court that enables state legislatures to threaten democracy, and then Congress decides whether to step in and stop state legislatures from doing that or not. And that's kind of the situation we're in, where there's a small risk in the 2024 presidential election that state legislatures might end up giving electoral college votes to presidential candidates who don't win their electorates in their states.
Yeah. You're touching on this a little bit, Jake, but I do want to pull it out a little bit more. I'm curious about the differences in the way of the nationalization of our state politics. I'm wondering what it looks like in democratically led state legislatures versus Republican state legislatures. What kind of policies are they passing? What are you noticing or seeing that are real differences here?
Great call. So on policies across the board, sort of issues like gun control and gun rights, climate policy and environmental regulation, taxing the wealthy, support for labor unions and workers, abortion restrictions and abortion rights, LGBT rights, issues of civil rights. All of these areas have seen huge changes at the state level over the past generation and much less important policy coming out of the national government. So this is a big contrast from the 1930s through the 1970s, there were huge deal national policies like Social Security, Medicare, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. All of these policies made states more similar in their sort of economic circumstances and their sort of civil rights, you know, and that there used to be a big difference. Some states essentially didn't allow any black people to vote, and states in the North did. The Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act come in and say, no, states have to be similar on civil rights. But there was a decline in that kind of national policymaking since the 1970s. But what happens is as a substitution was that states got much more involved in these policy areas. So conservative states became much more conservative in their policy and liberal states more liberal in their policy across the board on many issue areas. I would say that's pretty similar on the left and the right. For example, some conservative states cut taxes on the wealthy, whereas more liberal states increase taxes on high-income earners like millionaires. So that is a sort of symmetry there. By contrast, when it comes to policies towards elections, voting rights, and gerrymandering districts, those are much more one-sided, where it's been the Republican Party that's been sort of especially aggressive on those, restricting access to voting and especially really setting new records in the level of partisan gerrymandering in their district maps.
If you're just tuning in, this is Sam Corey speaking with Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Washington, Jake Grumbach. He's the author of Laboratories Against Democracy, How National Parties Transformed State Politics. Jake, one of the things I want to ask you about is just the gap in public opinion and policy that there often are at the state level, particularly on things like education and gun control. People, it seems like across the country, want more spending on gun control type legislation, and they also want more spending on education. They actually want a ton of spending on education, but there's a huge gap in where people are and where policy is, where states have actually implemented those policies. I was flabbergasted by that. But I'm curious why you see that, why state legislators fall behind on these policies particularly.
On education, for example, that's an area where, yes, as you said, consistently voters want greater spending for K through 12 education especially, and also to some extent, not quite as strong, but pretty strong on increased public higher education spending too. But what's happened is state level funding has been stagnant or really declined. So that's really out of step with public opinion. And there's a lot of reasons for that. So as we mentioned, it's really hard to know how to hold state legislators accountable if you're a voter. It's really hard. There's not much media coverage of what state legislators are doing. And some of my own research and research from others like Steve Rogers at the University of St. Louis really statistically shows that when state legislators vote for unpopular bills like cutting education spending, they're not punished by voters because voters don't really notice it. Whereas voters really do notice when a president has high gas prices or does something they don't like. There's a lot of media coverage and presidential approval tends to go down. It's not true of state legislatures. But a new big deal issue after the Supreme Court decision in the Dobbs ruling that allowed states to ban abortion, what we're seeing now is the rise of really unpopular bills to ban abortion in a number of states. States like Michigan that are somewhat poised to ban abortion really have pro-choice majorities of the mass public. So this is a new area we're seeing some out-of-step policy. And one reason why state legislators are able to get away with voting for an unpopular policy like an abortion ban is because of gerrymandering, because a more conservative, less urban, more rural set of voters that is against abortion rights, they often have the power to set state legislative majorities because of the gerrymandering of districts.
Just to unspool this a little bit more, because you noted on it, when lawmakers do, you know, pass legislation that's unpopular against, say, on education, and then they go out and then they run again, because this is the whole point of a small d democracy, right, is that you get to vote people out if they're not doing what you want them to do. The general public doesn't know about their record. And then also, I don't know, they hide behind, you know, broad national talking points from their party. Is that generally how this goes?
Really well said. So it's also, so part of it is the lack of information that we have about what our state legislators are doing. But the other side of this is that politics at the mass level has really become about cultural conflict nationally and a lot less about sort of your day-to-day economic policy. So now I like to sort of joke, but it's actually real. Statistically, if you want to know how somebody votes, you actually have a better shot of doing that by understanding their opinion of Colin Kaepernick or of, you know, Lizzo playing James Madison's flute. And sort of cultural iconography like that is actually a stronger predictor of which party somebody votes for than their opinion on health insurance or the minimum wage or other sort of economic and what we used to call kitchen table issues. So people are not currently as animated by things like whether or not they're going to have health insurance. They're a bit more animated by issues of culture and immigration these days.
Hmm. Jake, I want to take us back kind of to the start of your book, the things that kind of jump-started your research into this, which was you start kind of talking about national politics and how national politics and specifically passing legislation at the national level was just lagging behind. You're just not seeing big pieces of legislation being passed. Right now, we've had a lot of big spending. We've had the infrastructure bill, we've had the CHIPS Act, we've had the Inflation Reduction Act. Of course, this was a small bill, but we had the gun safety legislation. Are we in an anomalous period right now where the federal government is doing a lot to pass legislation and Congress is kind of getting its act at least somewhat together? Or do you think the federal government is actually on track to pass a lot more legislation, is actually doing a lot better to come together to get things done for the American people?
Yeah, that's a really great point about the COVID era actually did see a lot of bright spots when it comes to, you know, the national government passing economic policy to actually help give relief to the American people that was kind of economically necessary. So this extends through the end of the Trump administration, and Republican Congress actually engaged in some important relief spending as well. But then that ramped up in important ways in the Biden administration. As you mentioned, these are big deal national laws. Some had sort of sunset provisions and ended. So the child tax credit, while it was briefly the expanded child tax credit was in effect, that reduced child poverty dramatically. That was the biggest reduction in child poverty in 50 years or so. And then Congress decided not to renew that policy. But for some moments, this was a huge deal, and there was some consensus on these sorts of economic relief policies. So you're right, there was a brief exception, I think mostly due to COVID.
One of the things you proposed, Jake, to kind of solve our political woes, the federal government not passing enough legislation and giving too much power to states or focusing too much on states, which is just a reenactment of the nationalization or polarization of our politics at a more local level, is to give the federal government more power, is to give the federal government more say over our lives in terms of legislation and particularly in terms of voting rights, to strengthen voting rights. I'm curious why you think a stronger federal government will kind of solve our lack of representation issues, and what you make, and I know you've partially addressed this, but what you make to the counterclaim of like, hey, I love local and state politics. That's where I feel like I have a say. That's where I can actually be a part of politics because it's so hard to, I don't know, in touch with my Congress member or to actually feel like I'm part of politics.
That's right. So yeah, no, you hear it when you hear your state or local elected official running for office in their campaign, they're going to say, listen, I'm your local representative. I'm not like the distant fat cats in D.C. over there. So that's actually a crucial appeal. And that part of American culture, localism going back generations. But what I'm trying to show are the trade-offs of that type of system that puts a lot of emphasis on state and local policymaking. And you see this in a number of ways. So contrary to what we think, state and local political participation, that's people who vote in state and local elections, off cycle, people who donate money to state and local campaigns, people who go to state and local commission meetings, like local, you know, housing zoning meetings. These people are much more wealthy, you know, older, whiter, wealthier homeowners than the average person in a national election or people engaged in national politics. So it's actually a really unequal setting for politics to happen at the state and local level. So if you care about having the voice of young people, the working class, Black and Latino people, then the emphasis should be a bit more on national politics, contrary to our sort of conventional wisdom. But then we're talking more specifically now about policymaking and authority over things like voting rights and the rules of democracy itself. So this is a whole separate category of issues about the sort of rules of the game, not just are we going to tax the rich more or less or have a higher or lower minimum wage, like who is allowed to vote, how hard is it to vote, and how biased will our district maps be, and do we enforce that the candidate that wins the most votes is going to win the election, or do we give the electoral victory to another candidate? Those things are decided by states currently, but most countries around the world, stable, wealthy democracies, they have a national independent agency or commission that sets national rules for voting and election administration. And the fact that this is done at the state level in the U.S. is actually leaving American democracy kind of vulnerable to threat. So we have this hodgepodge system of election administration where basically one state or one county has the potential to cause a whole constitutional crisis nationally in this era of nationalized politics. That's a, you know, basically we're only as strong as our weakest link, and we have a lot of links in this chain in the U.S.
Mm. Jake Rumbach is the Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Washington. He's the author of Laboratories Against Democracy, How National Parties Transformed State Politics. Jake, thanks so much for being here with us.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. Thanks to producer Sam Corey for that wonderful interview with Professor Jake Rumbach. When we come back, we're going to look to the nearby state of Minnesota to understand how they instituted better public transit between the Twin Cities and how we might be able to learn something from them and get our acts together with public transit here in Southeast Michigan. Stay with us for more Detroit Today.